grab your beverages and turn up your interweb. Solving the world's problems 12 ounces at a time. It's Dudes and Beer. Well, hello everybody, and welcome to episode 298 of the Dudes and Beer podcast. I am Chris Jordan, your host, coming to you from Austin, Texas. Tonight, we will be talking to the amazing, the awesome Mark Fiorentino, author of the book Master of Reality, owner of the website super-relativity.com. We will be talking about exotic physics, alien technology, all kinds of fun things, how this works in the world around us, all kinds of intense scientific principles. So hold on to your hats, folks, for this amazing show. But before we get started, please do not forget the Dudes and Beer podcast is now officially brought to you by PodcastCadet.com. If you're a fan of podcasting like I am, want to start up a podcast for yourself, friends, family, fun, church, school, business, whatever, stop on by PodcastCadet.com today. That is the website that you want to go to. One-on-one podcast training is what they provide. Everything from one-on-one consultation on the technology that you need to use, how to distribute, how to monetize, how to brand your show. They hook you up one-on-one with individuals in the podcasting space, in the podcasting world, who are specialized in these industries, everything from A to Z, soup to nuts. That is what they provide. You need a show edited, produced, posted for you. They can do that as well. Stop on by today. PodcastCadet.com is the website. Dudes20 is the code that you want to use to save 20%. Our guest tonight, author of the amazing book I've got it here on my Kindle, Master of Reality, Mark Fiorentino is with us. He has a great story to tell us and a fantastic theory about relativity and a unified field theory. So welcome to the show, Mark. How are you today, sir?
Hello, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for taking the time to be on tonight and talk about this intense topic. I have been going through over the last probably 3-4 days and reading through Master of Reality. And some of the concepts that it puts forth are really forward-thinking when it comes to the way that physics is working, the way that quantum physics and, you know, quantum mechanics are actually proving a lot of this. So before we get started and really start kind of cracking the nut, go ahead and introduce yourself to our audience, how you came to write the book Master of Reality, and a little bit about yourself.
Hi, sure. Well, I started the book right after I retired. On the first day of retirement, I started writing the book. I had many, many ideas and notes over the years. My whole lifetime, I spent basically working on it on the side, you know, just for fun. It was like a hobby. I was very interested in science, physics, especially Albert Einstein. I was introduced to him very early on in my life, about the age of 10, to be precise. And I basically deeply admired him and his work, and especially his ideas concerning the unified field theory. When I first read about it, I was just amazed by it. I was entranced. I thought it was the best idea I ever heard, and I couldn't get it out of my head as a kid. And so everything that I read in science and I'm watching on TV and reading in UFO books or whatever, I tried to apply, well, how does this fit into the unified field theory? I was especially interested in the anti-gravity aspects, because I thought certainly gravity and anti-gravity, if it exists, which it appears it does, must fit into the unified field theory. And that's not even something that Einstein was working on back in his day. That was not seriously considered as something that is possible. So basically, I had a whole career working in the electronics industry and computers, and that helped me formulate some ideas about current flow, electron flow, and that got me thinking about physics even more. So that was a good career for me to get into. So that kept me thinking about science and physics and how electrons moved in the wire, and I would imagine it and try to visualize these things. And I learned to do a lot of thought experiments like Einstein from reading all of his biographies, and I realized that this is a good way to do science. Imagination is powerful, and the mind is the best lab of all. It's
absolutely.
It can do anything. So I definitely got into the world of science through technology, and I'm glad I did.
And you worked in various fields of the technological world. I mean, give us a little bit of background as far as some of the places that you've worked, things that you have done in your life that kind of led you down this path of theory to begin with.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, I started out in electronics. First, before that, it was media technology, but that was really kind of a going nowhere kind of a deal. So I got out of that and then went back to school and studied electronics. And then after I got out of tech school, I had a really interesting job at Harris Government Systems. And for a year, I worked on a killer satellite program. And it was very interesting work. And they had a lot of other interesting things going on in those labs in Melbourne, Florida. Palm Bay was where the plant was. And I loved that job, but the pay was kind of low here in Florida. So after a year, I jumped over to IBM in North Carolina, Charlotte, and worked there for 16 years and worked on many projects, first as in the realm of testing circuit cards and circuit boards and stuff. Then I wrote some programs that analyzed circuit boards. Once I got very good at it, then I developed a program to simulate my thoughts and processes to help the other people solve problems and fix cards faster. And I received a very large award for that because it was a very successful program. Saved the company a lot of money.
I'll bet.
And it could fix cards that nobody could fix, and they were going to get scrapped otherwise. So that led me into the quality department out of manufacturing, and that's when I started getting into more of a design and research and testing and developing, and eventually went to R&D labs and worked in the test areas there where I designed fixtures and programs to automate testing of memory and computers and scanners and other things of that nature. So I got some more awards for those things that I developed over there in those labs. And then came back to Florida, worked in ImageSoft for a while. It's a very nice company, very interesting software company. And eventually semi-retired back to where I live now in Winter Haven and worked in an IT department for the final few years of my life and then retired.
And that's when you find yourself really, like you were saying, coming to a head with this and with the final throes of just finishing a book because you have the time to finish it now. But your years of work is what fascinated me. And especially there's a story that you shared in Master of Reality, a problem solving story about how you helped a gentleman earn his master's degree with a geometric problem solving that you basically used. Explain, because I think that really kind of number one, the way it seemed to me in the book was very much an aha moment for you. That even though you had processed data like this your whole life, it was the first time that you ever realized, wait a minute, I do this in a different way than other people.
Exactly. I noticed a pattern in his equation that he just didn't see. He had several degrees solved already, because this was an equation or that evolved, because each dimension it had to grow, so there would be a new solution for each dimension, which would be in modulo 2 mathematics or binary mathematics. Every time you go up to the next power, then the equation changes to find the solution for that dimension or for that power. So he had it solved for the first three dimensions. And I saw a geometric pattern in the equation, which is very different thinking than the most. I don't think anybody would have ever thought to look for a geometric pattern in the structure of the equation. But yeah. I just said, oh, I get this. This is going to be a symmetrical geometric thing that could probably be easily solved no matter what the dimension. And as you go up higher, when you get to binary 2 of the 20th power, I mean, the possibilities for that equation go into the millions.
Yeah.
So to try and solve that brute force with a computer would take days or weeks. And, you know, I was able to go up from the third dimension all the way up to the eighth or ninth.
Wow.
In a matter of a couple hours, basically saying, okay, the pattern is going to look like this now. And this next one, to be symmetrical, it'll look like this. And so, I wrote a little program to test them out real quick to make sure I was getting it right. And they kept checking. And the higher the dimension went, the faster I was solving
wow.
the equations. So then I brought it to them the next day. And Tom was very excited when he saw that. He says, I knew you could solve it. Something told me. And then he went to his professor, and his professor said it was new math, you know, congratulating him. This is nothing that was known before. And so when I heard that, I couldn't sleep that night. I was so excited, because only the greats in history discover new math.
Yeah.
Einstein, yeah. Newton.
Well, and even in what I love, because I myself am in the field of audiovisual, and one of the catchphrases we have in the video department is pixels are a beautiful thing. Like the power of the pixel is absolutely amazing, but you really do have to understand that geometric math that you're talking about in order to break that down. And even here recently, one of my favorite scientists, Mandelbrot, just celebrated his birthday. And without him, folks, we would not have fractal geometry. So this is really like what you discovered was really verging on that kind of equation and technology and repetitive nature of geometric patterns.
Yeah, it was an evolutionary kind of formula, a math formula. It evolves with each dimension as it goes higher in a geometric, simple geometric pattern.
Yeah.
And so that made me realize, I thought about how did I solve that, and then I thought, well, this was pattern recognition. To
yeah.
me, this was nothing more than a sophisticated SAT question. You know, the ones where they have a dot and a square and a line, and then
yep.
a square and a line and a dot, and you know, it's one of those kind of questions. And the trick is to predict which pattern is the next pattern that's going to, you know,
yeah.
make sense with the other ones. And so I finally did. I got suspicious when I started thinking about it. I says, I'm a pretty ordinary guy. I don't really classify myself as a genius. How did I manage to do this solution? And how did I manage to do this with the unified field theory solution? Because I'm a pretty much an ordinary guy that seems to have been able to accomplish an extraordinary thing. So I did test myself online. I says, well, the thing you seem to be able to do best is pattern recognition.
Sure.
So I went and did a test. I shouldn't have done it when I was so tired, because I fell asleep during the test twice. Hope that didn't damage my score, but I still managed to score 141 IQ for pattern recognition.
Wow.
So that makes sense to me. I should be better than average at that.
Well, and what that really comes to play into whenever you're talking about computing and technology, like that utterly has to play into the world of graphics, graphic generation. Just like I was saying, until fractal geometry was discovered in the way that it was, where it was like, wait a minute, a pine tree is an example of a fractal. A sunflower is an example of a fractal. You know, the inside of a rose, same thing, because it's a repetitive pattern. And once they realized that this occurred in nature, it really allowed the people designing graphics processors and designing AR, VR programs, things like that, to get rid of the angles that were there and start to smooth things out and turn angular mountains into cascading hills, and more fine defined shapes, because now the computer can assume what's going to be there instead of having to utterly generate it from scratch.
Exactly. Yeah, I would have to agree. There is certainly, and it makes sense too, because in my early days, I was really into art and graphics. Mm. So that kind of got my mind to be able to visualize these problems. So I'm a very visual person. So there was a lot of mind experiments going on. And when I was writing this book, especially, I would wake up at 3 and then think about things like the motion of particles and stuff all the way from 3 to 5 or 6 in the morning. I would just kind of work these things out visually in my, with what you're saying.
Yeah. And let's start getting into that a little bit, because I know so many people that do, like, I'm somebody that I tell people that I wire cabinets in my sleep. I build racks of equipment like what's here behind me. That's my counting sheep, you know. And for a long time, I actively went to sleep with the idea of looking for the solution to a problem.
Exactly.
And that was something that Einstein was a big practitioner of, Edison, Tesla. A lot of people do that, where you're using that kind of spare space in your mind that's there and absolutely processing something. You wouldn't be dreaming if your brain wasn't processing something, right? So right. Kind of the idea is that you can play with these ideas and not be so hung up with the constructs that you're used to.
Exactly.
And be able to, I use it all the time whenever I'm troubleshooting a circuit, I'm designing things like that. So let's start getting into, and even Einstein himself said that the formula for relativity, the theory of relativity, came to him in a dream.
Yeah, so that's very interesting.
let's kind of start diving into your unified theory, because I find it very interesting. As someone who is scientifically minded, I love reading science. To me, reading scientific texts, things like that, make more sense to me than reading novels.
I'm the same way.
I just grew up reading instruction manuals and crazy books at the library when I was a kid, because that was my hobby. That's what I did. You know, I tinkered with circuits. I played around with them, and it became a natural thing for me later to move into this realm. And I think so many people have that propensity. They just aren't encouraged to follow it. So, what was it that encouraged you to start following this path of the unified theory of relativity that you have formulated?
It started really, Yeah, I never really set out in life to solve the unified field theory. I always thought I would read somebody else solving it. And so I was always reading these articles and books and such, waiting to hear the day that somebody else would solve it. Now, there's a few things, some things that are kind of spiritually happening that said something was coming in my future that was very important, but I didn't know what. So all I knew is it would have something to do with inventing something or discovering something, but I really didn't know why. So there was that spiritual aspect that was got my attention. And the other thing was early on when the nuns asked me to look up somebody that was born on my birthday. It was a saint, and I discovered Albert Einstein was born on my birthday. So I gave a report on him instead of a saint. So those kinds of things kind of started to steer me gently in this direction. Although I tried many other things. I wrote programs and tried to sell programs. And I was always trying to build perpetual motion machines. Was very interested in free power and power generation and such. So there was those kind of things that started me on the path. But once I finally decided to write this book, it was my last good idea. And I says, well, I might as well give this a shot. And I knew there was a lot of happy thoughts, things that really made sense. When you read my book and you get it, when you understand it, it makes sense. And it's almost the person when they get it and they have this realization, it's like I liken it to remembering, because it is my opinion that before we were born, we all knew this. We all knew how the unified field theory worked.
Yeah.
We were just forced to go through the veil of forgetfulness. And when we're born, we don't have any recollection of our past lives or any of the knowledge that you have when you're connected to God on the other side. But when you hear something that rings true, it's really coming from a memory of something that you really already knew, and you recognize it. And it's an awakening, basically. So for me, this theory was a grand awakening, and I want to impart this upon the people of the world and help them realize that the solution is now here. And at the end of the book, I finally realized myself, when I went over each chapter at least 10 times, I says, this is actually a unified field theory. I mean, you actually have the solution here. A bunch of more things that physicists haven't fundamentally explained. So this is important. And then I started to step forward from that point when that book was finished.
Well, and, you know, it's interesting to me because as you're saying, these two things, the metaphysical and the physical, are intrinsically intertwined. And it is more and more the realm of quantum physics, physics itself. Even all of a few years ago, 2013, there were the computer scientists that actively proved that God exists. Through mathematical equation. It was pretty interesting. But even the concept of the Aristotelian prime mover, you know, like that goes back to pre-Christian philosophy. And it's very, very interesting to me to see that this metaphysical concept is starting to work its way into the realm of physics.
Mm-hmm. Well, all of this theory that I have, this completion, really, I have to give 90% credit to Albert Einstein, 90+%.
Well, I mean, granted, I would think that anybody working in any realm of the P word physics would have to credit at least a good 60% of their work to Albert Einstein.
Now, I did come up with some new stuff, but let's face it, the unified field theory, as he envisioned it, which basically is this simple statement: electromagnetism and gravity emerge as aspects of a single fundamental field. That basically,
yes,
I proved is correct.
Well,
he was absolutely correct in
and,
that.
And that's just it. Like there's a big there. But we are seeing this regularly now. There was an article about magnetic fields that I posted just the other day that scientists were able to manipulate magnetic fields via distance. So
what technique was it?
Hold on. I will find the article. I actively just brought up the article from the Independent that came out last week talking about how the brain, once they map the human brain, it oddly looks just like the way that they've mapped the universe. like it's the wildest thing in the world to look at the two images next to each other. It looks like you just took them in a different spectrum.
Oh yeah,
like there's a color shift between them.
Looks a lot like the brain image.
Oh, but it's absolutely phenomenal to go through and see that. And let me see. Hold on, magnetic fields via distance. Let me see what I can find on that real quick, because it was just the other day that I posted an article about it. And I want to say, because that was a huge breakthrough. The fact that they were able to manipulate a magnetic field from a distant place
using their thoughts.
I'm not sure. Hold on, I don't know if it was via thought. There's the Live Science article that talks about how the brain can sense the Earth's magnetic field,
you can manipulate the shape of a field by introducing ferrous materials nearby, and the shape kind of bends toward the iron or whatever, or other magnets, then the magnetic field will react to that. Could be that sort of thing.
Yes.
Well known, and thanks to Michael Faraday, we have a good understanding of magnetism and a good understanding of how currents create magnetism, and magnetism can create currents, the whole electromagnetic process, which I was able to use in my book thanks to Faraday and Maxwell. There was another breakthrough I had in my book concerning electromagnetism and the motion of particles.
Well,
it all comes down to the motion of particles. That's the key thing that unites electromagnetism to gravity.
Well, let's start getting into that a little bit real quick. How is it that, because of course we know the theory of relativity and the concept of theoretical space, all that kind of stuff. But how is it that magnetism, and I think a lot of people don't realize how key magnetism is to electronics, electricity, everything. And the fact that even Nikola Tesla used the term ether, and we'll kind of get into that with you some this evening, because that was a old term that came from alchemical texts, philosophic texts, just this force that is generally around us that we can tap into.
Yes. Yeah, definitely the ether. I just wrote a little document on it. I've uploaded it to my blog. Does the ether exist?
Mm-hmm.
The ether is absolutely primary in my theory, and it really was primary in Einstein's theory, other than the brief period when he came out with special relativity.
Yeah.
And in my book, you'll eventually get to those chapters where I break down why he abandoned the theory, the theory of directly during that time period. Yeah. And well, I present a lot of evidence there.
Because that's just it. He came up with the, and that's what a lot of people don't realize, that the special theory of relativity was just a slice of a larger picture that he had in mind that he was working on. And that, of course, gets a lot of attention, as well it should. But even he himself was like, listen, man, that's there. But I don't think you're seeing, I think you're getting a little myopic in your thought right now. And you really got wowed by the wow factor when you should have kept moving on.
Yeah, there's things that there were statements that he made. He deliberately disassociated with the ether. Considering that theory, the math in that theory, the Lorentz transformations were based on ether theory model. Lorentz had that, and Einstein believed in the ether all the way up to the Michelson and Morley experiment. And Einstein knew about that experiment beforehand. So he knew that the ether was not going to be confirmed. Precisely, the ether wind was not going to be detected. So knowing that in advance, he wrote these statements in about the ether, that he didn't need an ether. This theory doesn't need an ether, which, you know, surprised, I'm sure, Lorentz. And it's surprising in that the equations all really were based on an ether model and a motion of the electron through the ether model. And why at the last second he did that, because he knew that that announcement was going to be made. And so to make sure his theory wasn't discredited or ignored, he made the whole theory of special relativity about motion relative to another frame of reference and not relative to the ether stationary background. And everybody bit on that. I mean, it was a sleight of hand, and everybody full commit to that idea. And we have a problem in modern physics today because they've misinterpreted what special relativity really means. Those transformations are real transformations. It's not just about the increase in mass. Those are real things that happen to the frame of reference, the moving object, as it accelerates towards the speed of light. And general relativity proved that. And he used special relativity to develop general relativity, and it's what he called his happiest thought. And the ether is really crucial to solving the unified field theory. You have to realize that it really does exist, and it plays the major role in everything in development, like you're wondering about magnetism. Well, let's go into that for a moment. What is magnetism? Well, it's one of the three primary forces of nature. Magnetism occurs, and pay close attention to this, because this is right at the core of fundamental physics. And so what is magnetism? Magnetism happens as a result of moving charge. You're not going to ever get a magnetic field unless there's a charge moving in the area, like an electron. An electron is a electromagnetic charge, but the magnetic component of that charge only appears when that charge moves. And that's part of the main part of how we're going to get to the unification of all forces. That when the charge moves, since the charge is a twist of space, an electrostatic twist of space, it's a field, a different type of bending of space, and the space I'm talking about is the ether. When that charge moves, it's a twist, it causes a magnetic field to emerge as it's moving through space. The space around that charge rotates in reaction to the twisted field as it's moving through the ether. So it makes clear and perfect sense now that the magnetism is nothing more than a rotational reaction of the ether to a moving charge. It's just that simple. And Faraday proved that, and Maxwell doubled down on that and also proved it. So that's what really how magnets work. It's just that they have charges moving in a specific coherent pattern within the metal of the magnet, yeah, that creates the magnetic field, and it persists as long as those charges within that magnet are moving in that circular pattern. You're going to get magnetic fields, and whenever an electron moves in a wire, it emits the magnetic field as it's moving. So that's all what magnetism is. It's just that simple.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, it's funny because it's it can be a purposeful product, but it's really a byproduct that we could be using and reusing to generate energy, all kinds of good stuff. I mean, our whole principle of generating energy to begin with comes off of harnessing electromagnetic energy, and turning huge turbines that are just motors in reverse. Instead of using electricity to turn the motor, you're turning the motor and generating electricity by moving
the magnets brush by the coils of wire, and whenever that happens, current flows.
Yeah.
And it's part of the pattern that needed to be recognized. So the key to unifying gravity has to come from the same mechanical mechanism. It's really almost all goes all the way back to Newton.
Yeah. I mean,
all of this is going to turn out to be mechanics.
Oh,
simple, straightforward mechanics.
Well, and it's really wild once you start realizing that, and once you start realizing that magnetism is such a force within all of this. I know Tesla did a lot of work in that realm. Everything that we basically use to harness, produce, and transport electricity as of right now is all based on the patents of Nikola Tesla.
Tesla was a genius of amazing powers. He was a visionary, and he had really mastered the whole electromagnetic. He had a deep understanding of how they worked. That's how he was able to develop these new machines, because he knew what was kind of going on at a deep level. He certainly understood the relationships of electrostatic charge and how it works, and magnetism.
Yeah.
And he created all kinds of stuff, including the radio, which he didn't initially get credited for.
Yep.
As Marconi did, but Marconi's designs were actually
would not have happened without Tesla's work.
Yeah, and he was eventually, after his death, I think he was granted the patents for the radio and so forth.
Well, and you know, just going into that and realizing, just to start making these dot connections for people that may know a little bit of something here and there, from their studies in school, things like that. Now, once you start marrying magnetism to that Einstein concept of spooky action at a distance, and the idea of, like you were saying, electromagnetism only happens when the electron is in motion. If the electron is static and sitting there, sure there is a charge, but it's much more of a potential charge than it is an active charge.
If you notice, like with a Van de Graaff machine, you generate a huge electrostatic charge. There's not a magnetic charge really associated with that electrostatic field until the charges within that field move.
Yeah.
Then a magnetism emerges. In every case, it always comes down to this. It always comes down to, you're not going to have magnetism unless there's a moving charge somewhere.
Yeah.
So that's two-thirds 2/3 of the way to unifying the forces of nature. The only one left to explain is gravity. And if you like, I will link that one right now for you.
Please, because I think that it is absolutely time for that to start happening, which is right up around where I am in the book, where these start coming together. So I'm not really concerned about spoilers. So spoil away.
Well, I just want to complete the thought of the unified field theory for you at the very basic fundamental level. So we know motion of particles has something to do with gravity, electromagnetic particles. So we got to identify, what I did is identify what kind of particle and what type of motion will do the trick, because there's different types of motion. And the key really comes from the pattern. Again, this is another SAT question in my head. I see that Newton discovers force equals mass times acceleration. So I'm interested in mass. So what's left? I have manipulate that formula, and I find that force in motion, accelerated motion, makes mass. Does anybody really get that deeply? No. But somehow Newton got that and was a tremendous advancement. Then the next person to link mass to motion was Einstein, E equals mc squared. We have a mass, we have not a force this time. Force and energy are slightly different things. But an energy in motion is equivalent to mass. There's a pattern emerging here. We had energy, motion, mass. So then finally, Einstein has a great discovery. He discovers that acceleration and gravity are somehow equivalent. That's the equivalency principle, a main part of general relativity, another clue. So I know now that accelerated motion is the key to generating mass. And now I'm on the threshold of the dream. So the final step was to understand what accelerated motion is. And there's actually two types. There's the uniform accelerated motion, which is motion in a straight line with a constant acceleration. We're all familiar with that. That's like when you put your foot on the gas and you accelerate and you feel yourself getting pushed back into the chair.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's uniform accelerated motion. And then the other one, the real deal maker, is uniform circular motion. This is accelerated because the velocity of charge is due to the continuous change in the direction of the motion. The velocity changes due to continuous change in the direction of motion. Thus, for a body moving in a circular path at a constant speed, its velocity changes continuously. This is the key. We're linking Einstein's equivalency principle to a specific type of particle motion. Now I'm going to close the deal. So what I discovered was this phrase, gravity is equal to the accelerated motion of unbalanced charges. And those charges I'm talking about are usually fundamental. So what does that mean? So when we take something like quarks that exist inside of the neutron and the proton, they're actually moving in a circular pattern. That's accelerated motion. And precisely what I discovered is they're moving in a trefoil type of pattern, which is a trefoil knot, which is a very simple form of knot that makes perfect sense to be what those quarks are moving in. So they're moving in a uniform circular motion, which is an accelerated motion. Now I have the mechanism to form mass right inside of neutrons and protons. And all I need is for those particles to move like that. And when they move in this accelerated pattern of motion, what happens, here's the clincher, there's a contraction of space in and around those particles as they move. That ether is transformed, it's condensed slightly by this motion, because that motion inside of those particles, the neutron and the proton, the trefoil pattern is actually spinning as well and precessing. Eventually what you get what happens is you get a spinning sphere, and that's perfect to generate uniform gravitational attraction around the perimeter of that sphere. And that's the unification of gravity to electromagnetism. It's an electromagnetic particle moving in an accelerated fashion that causes the emergence of gravity. And it's just that simple. And that's why somebody as simple as me could figure it out. If it was really something to do with something really complex like quantum mechanics or string theory, I could have never gotten that.
Well,
unfortunately, it wasn't anything to do with
that. And I think that, and not that people in the realm of quantum mechanics, string theory, things like that, are not necessary for this work and to prove this theorem that you have, you know. As you were talking and describing that, I was actively throwing up the article that I posted on the Dudes and Beer group on Facebook the other day from Brookhaven National Laboratories. This was released September 3rd of this year. A Large Hadron Collider creates matter from light.
Yeah.
Is the title of the article. And the parts that I was highlighting were even talking about exactly what you were talking about. Here's the part that reads, inside CERN's accelerator complex, protons are accelerated to close the speed of light. Their normally rounded forms squish along the direction of motion. And special relativity supersedes the classical laws of motion for processes taking place at the Large Hadron Collider. The two incoming protons see each other as compressed pancakes accompanied by an equally squeezed electromagnetic field, of course created because, number one, it's a bunch of huge magnets. Number two, you're also moving the electrons and protons. You're moving these things. So once you get them moving, they're going to create an electromagnetic field of their own.
I would agree with 90% of what's said there.
Now, granted, maybe, that's
maybe
just a
100%,
snippet.
But that's just certainly 90%.
That's just
definitely
a snippet.
Flattened out. They have the right image, the true image of what's happening. And I'm glad that they're considering special relativity when they accelerate those particles to the speed of light.
Well, yeah. And I mean, even the next part where it talks about the protons graze each other, their squished electromagnetic fields intersect. These fields skip the classical amplify etiquette, which is if you put two beams of light together, it makes an equivalently brighter beam of light. But because these two are grazing each other and not necessarily intersecting fully, these other special laws come into effect. And really interesting just to go through and, like I was saying, see that modern physics is backing up these concepts and theories that are there.
Well, certainly some of them do, and it really what matters is the proper interpretation.
Yes.
If you don't get the proper interpretation, you get problems in understanding, and there's a lot of problems in quantum mechanics interpretation, especially
sure.
Quantum field theory. That's a mess, and that's not sensible, and everybody's complaining about it, and rightly so. There is a whole bunch of various field theories and
yeah.
Quantum theories in general, interpretations, that there's so many of them, I'm very suspicious that there's something wrong already because you have more than one. And you got, you know, maybe a half a dozen or more different theories about what's the cause of things in reality.
Well, and not only that, but you've also got, as we talk about on this show regularly, that religion of science that is out there.
Yes,
that
dogma.
Just because it is only provable in this quantifiable way, it's not provable to us.
Right.
And to me, a lot of that needs to go out of the window. I think that people need to remember that that you are allowed to hypothesize anything in the world.
You can.
That's where theory and experiment and things like that come in to prove or disprove hypothesis.
I'd like to finish up and link this final thoughts on unification of gravity.
Absolutely.
There's one last thing. It's called Einstein's Happiest Thoughts in the book, Amir D. Excel's book, entitled God's Equation. And this plays right into what I was just saying. Remember how I said things accelerated, the electromagnetic particle accelerated, and it causes the contraction? Well, Einstein really kind of was the first guy to discover that. It was his happiest thought, and I'm going to read it to you, and then I'm going to tell you why it was his happiest thought. Einstein followed the line of reasoning that began with his happiest thought of his life. Still at the Swiss Patent Office, he conducted one of his famous thought experiments. Einstein imagined a circle spinning in space. The center of the circle did not move, but its circumference was moving quickly in a circular direction. Einstein compared what happened in several reference frames, a standard tool he had used in developing the special relativity theory. He concluded, using his special relativity, that the boundary of the disk contracted as it spun. I just said the same thing to you just a few minutes ago. Where did I get the idea initially? From Einstein. There was a force acting at the circle at the boundary, the centrifugal force, and its action was analogous to that of the gravitational force. But the same contraction that affected the outer circle left the diameter unchanged. Thus, Einstein concluded in a way that surprised even him, the ratio of a circle to the diameter was no longer pi. He deduced in the presence of a gravitational force or field, the geometry of space was non-Euclidean. What does that mean? It was bent in a certain way. You can't bend something that doesn't exist. So therefore, the ether must exist. And it's his happiest thought because he realized the mechanical method for creating gravity. He just had to figure out exactly what was going on inside of neutrons and protons, but he didn't know because he didn't know they had quarks inside of them. He died 10 years before that discovery.
Wow.
So what I just presented to you is authoritative proof of how the theory of relative special relativity and my theory, super relativity, explain gravity. It comes from Einstein, basically, and I just worked out the details.
And gravity plays into so many things. Gravity, without the specific gravity that we have here on this planet, we would not have life. It plays into so much on so many levels. And that in and of itself, the gravity, one of my favorite shows in the world, my son watches it on Netflix. It's called Storybots. And one of their first shows, they actively just explain gravity to children. And the warping of space-time. And I was like, wow, this is great. This is a show for like 5-year-olds, man. And they are going into like the warping of space-time by objects and their mass. And it's like, wow, that's great. You know, like I was in my 20s before I knew that. That's awesome. So going into that and just looping back to what I was talking about earlier, that spooky action at a distance, that fact that there are other things within the ether and space that are connected to the physical.
Yeah. Spooky action at a distance. That's a story I could spend 30, 40 minutes on. To explain, because I had to try and reconcile that in order to prove Einstein right.
That's the thing, is that like it really is a noodle scratcher, because it without it you can't further in the work of Einstein.
Yeah, because he's basically saying that that can't really be possible, that, that somehow these particles are communicating at superluminal speeds, but yeah, not violating special relativity. And that goes because there was a false assumption made. And I call this type of false assumption referring confusion. You take a series of facts, then you come up with the wrong conclusion. And basically, that's what everybody did where that experiment was concerned. The solution for that thing is remarkably simple. I could explain it. I don't know if you want to get into all of that, but there is no spooky action at a distance.
Okay.
That's the bottom line.
All right.
There is no spooky act. When you have particles that are, what's the term they use, entangled.
Yes.
What that really means is that when they were created, they had a relationship.
Yes.
One was had a polarization one way and one had the opposite polarization. And then they go out and they measure one and then they say, well, I know this one now. When I measure the other one, I'll know what it is because we know that they're oppositely polarized.
Sure.
And there's no magic there. There's magic when they say that the measuring of the one affects the other. It doesn't. And basically all that really happens there and why things got confused is they started running these particles through polarizers and they were changing the statistical behavior and outcome of the experiment. And that change made the quantum mechanics equations work better than the standard probability equations that were the classical ones.
Gotcha.
So there's a slight difference. And they say that slight difference proves that there's spooky action at a distance and the reality is non-local. The catastrophic misinterpretation of what happened. Really, all that happens is the statistics were changed. They used tuning parameters to adjust the equation so that the quantum mechanics formulas win in predicting the results of those experiments because they account for the wave-like properties.
Okay.
They better account for the wave-like properties of particles that are entangled. So they get a result that's more accurate. They've interpreted that to mean there's spooky action at a distance. There is no spooky action at a distance. It was just the way the experiment was set up, and we've altered the outcome slightly. Whenever you interact with a particle, you change it. And it changed in a way that they could predict properly with their equations, and they sure misinterpreted it. That's my stand on it.
Okay.
And
okay,
I spent years writing articles on that over and over. I tried to do the spooky action at a distance, and I conceived this whole method where they could possibly be literally physically entangled. Mm. And as they stretch apart, as that space between them stretches, it's communicating back and forth. As you tighten and stretch it, the speed of light changes, becomes faster between those two particles. It was nonsensical. I tried too hard. I bit into the apple just like everybody else and assumed that there was spooky action at it.
Well, and it's a theory that I love.
It's neat. Yeah, it's definitely neat.
I mean, you know, it's kind of like Schrodinger's cat, you know. It's one that's thrown around a lot. And I love asking people in your world who have worked in your world about it. Because there's a lot of people that try to use it to explain a lot of things. But those things can be explained via other means to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, well, I think I've got that explanation. Time will tell if somebody ever agrees and can back that up somehow. I suggest, changes with the usage of the polarizers, if there's a way not to use polarizers. Because there's interesting things that happen when, did you know that, did you ever take sunglasses, two sunglasses that have polarized film
yes
in it, and twist them until the light blanks out.
Yeah.
Well, that's not mysterious, because you're just figuring that, you know, it's blocking half of the light at a certain angle and the other half when you twist it to 90 degrees. Well, if you add a third one at some 45 degree angle, the blocking stops and you get half the light back. That mystifies physicists, because adding a third one should diminish the light.
Should decrease the light.
But it instead increases. And if you add another one, you might increase it some more. It depends on the angle that it's at.
Yeah.
And maybe somebody understands it out there. I haven't seen it yet.
Well, and once again, that only comes right back to geometry. It just comes right full circle to the problem that you helped the gentleman solve so long ago. And
exactly right.
And that's what I think a lot of people have a problem grasping, Mark, is the literal fractal way in ways that this information is used, that this technology is used, that technology feeds off the information. It really is a continuous feed loop that is really amazing. And even to the point where now, all of a few years ago at the, I used to love working the NVIDIA conference. And I sat there with,
love those video cards.
Oh yeah. Yeah. But it was wild to see what people were doing with them, where they were like live mapping the surface of the sun, you know, and doing, trying to do like sunspot, prediction, things like that. Just wild, amazing stuff. And when you hear one of the heads of Lockheed Martin come up and talking about how Moore's Law is getting ready to collapse, this was about 4 years ago, three, 4 years ago that conference happened. And they're already talking about it now, about the fact that, like, yeah, get ready for a whole new world of computing, folks. Because it's here, it is upon us. Now, what we do with that technology is really incumbent upon us, you know. Like, to see articles like they made matter out of light, that is welcome to the Star Trek replicator and the ability to feed everybody.
Yeah, well, if you crash two photons head on into each other, they make electrons and positrons.
Yeah,
so that's matter.
So yeah, it's like, and when you hear articles from 2012 about the scientists that transported light particles, like, this technology is already among us. It's already here. Mm-hmm. So to hear your theories and the way that these things are tied together, to me, is awesome. It makes for a great, a bright, a beautiful future for mankind if we can really start
that's to what it's all about,
open
a
this
utopian
up.
Future. That's what I'm trying to help create.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I'm going to get crazy with you here real quick, because right. I know that we've only got you for about an hour and we're right up against that time right now. I don't want to keep you too long on this evening.
Go longer if you want more time. Well, I don't mind.
Okay. We'll go a little while longer, but I don't like taxing people on their first episode, and I definitely want you back again and again.
Oh, okay, because we'll save some for some. I'll definitely come back. Questions.
I love talking this kind of stuff, because there are so many things that are happening out there. I follow so many different RSS feeds from the world of science, and when I see things like that article that came out in the first breaths of it were back in August, September, things like that. But and of course you hear about these things, you know, you hear about the fact that they transported light. Well, did they transport light? You know, or was it a faulty sensor? And then it took years for them to verify, well, it wasn't a faulty sensor. Like, it's amazing some of the checks that they go through on this stuff, and the fact that we find out about these headlines years after the breakthrough happened. because they've sent it through 2-3 different rungs of people, double checking, triple checking, just making sure that numbers are right. Even taking that curve into light, the fact that some of these experiments have been going on for years and the results are just now being calculated and figured out. It is an amazing, amazing future. And one of the questions that I would have for you is, if matter can be created from light, could that matter be intelligent?
There's a lot of people kind of interested in that. And if you want to go that right, matter and energy, they're really the same thing in different manifestations.
Sure. Sure. And,
you know, of course, the equations prove that.
Well, and that's just it. There's two ways to read that E equals MC squared. You can read it forward or you can read it backward. Mm-hmm. And it's right. Just as valid either way.
So is matter or light intelligent? I think they both come from an intelligence. And that intelligence is God. So my theory is basically an intelligent design theory. And I go into that in the final chapters in the book, my cosmology theory. So that all matter and energy, all the laws of physics, are established by the Creator through the power of intention. And this is verified through other people who have had near-death experiences, and they come back and give the same description, a description that's handed to them from God. So I take that evidence. Maybe a physicist doesn't take that evidence seriously, but I do, because there's a lot of people that are coming back and explaining it. I have it on my website blog. Father Rick Wendell is just one example who has been told how the universe was created in the laws of physics that are immutable. They come from the Creator. This whole system obviously is an intelligent design system. It works. It's tuned so perfectly for life. That's by no accident. And the design itself is so clever. I found things in it myself, clues, the neutron being one of them, the odd behavior of the neutron, and I was able to make sense of why its behavior is so odd versus the proton, and able to find a reasonable explanation and function for its oddity. And that odd behavior is basically, if you isolate a neutron in space somewhere away from everything else, that neutron will decay in about 15 minutes into a proton and an electron. Now, why is that significant? Because a proton and electron turn into hydrogen when they are formed together. So hydrogen is what we need to form the universe. So I said, well, that means that the neutron must play a key role in the beginning when the Big Bang happened. And you'll see in those later chapters, I link it all together, and it makes perfect sense how the universe is formed, and a neutron plays the major role in all of that.
Well, and once you start breaking it all down, it really does come to particles and frequencies. The frequency is the equivalent of rotation. You know, how many times that atom or particle is rotating. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing right. What you can start achieving in the world. Even once you start looking at, and a lot of people call the man a little kooky, but the guy up in Canada, oh my God, that's it. He plays around with wild electronic fields and claims to be able to shift matter and move matter. Even if you go back and look at a lot of the ancient alchemical texts from the 1500s, things like that, that is what they are talking about, is the transmutation of matter, the transmutation of elements. And
the old alchemist stuff.
And I've been on a tear of reading alchemical texts over the last 6 months, just since COVID started, and just collecting them on my Kindle and reading them and reading them and reading them. Because I love reading philosophy. I love reading instruction manuals. I love one of my favorite things out there is the Great Courses series with Amazon. I finished a 13-part lecture series on thermodynamics, man. Like, while I was sitting in my living room programming websites during my son's nap.
So you're a lot like me. I'm interested in the same kind of reading. I don't go in for fiction very much.
Yeah. Like, my wife will sit back and like tear through a Stephen King novel. I'm over here like, you know, reading physics documents and things like that. And half of it, you know, the calculations go over my head, but it's the gross principles that I love digging into, the theory behind it, the concept behind it.
Right.
And like you're saying, even you yourself not being a classically trained mathematician, were able to help discover new math.
Yeah, it's a thing that I scratch my head about and wonder, and that's why I did some investigation of myself to see, you know, how I was able to accomplish these things. And a lot of it has to do with my training and the things that I wasn't trained in, like quantum mechanics. If I had been a physicist, a regular physicist, and went to physics schools and got trained in quantum mechanics, I would have had it beat out of me to think this way. They don't even like you to think in classical terms. They will tell you particles do not have position. Particles do not have momentum. They don't exist. They only exist when you look at them. They will talk you. They will talk you.
And
out
that's
of
the craziest
this
thing
theory.
In the world. That's the craziest thing in the world for them to say. It's like, how can you say that there is no intelligence to matter, but yet still say that the electron cannot be photographed unless it knows it's going to be photographed?
Yeah.
Right. Like, you just totally contradicted your own principle to prove your own principle.
A lot of people have problems with quantum mechanics because it makes no sense.
It's like you just totally negated your own principle in order to prove your own principle. That's like, wow. Like, that's a mind job.
That. Thank you for bringing that up.
Because, I mean, that's one of my favorite things to bring up is the fact that, yes, particles are, there is an intelligence that is there.
I do believe that there is an intelligence to everything. And if you raise your level of consciousness to the point where you can connect to that stuff, you could probably you could change the way things happen and at the molecular and the subatomic level even.
Yeah.
There are many instances of miracles that have occurred to people who have had near-death experiences where they've had cancer and died. We're told they were going to get cured. When they came back, they were sent back. And one lady in particular who had cancer all through her body was riddled with it. Within a matter of days, it was removed. So somebody having to do with God or God himself removed all of that. And that took some sort of a manipulation of all the atoms and molecules in her body to destroy and remove that cancer. We call that a miracle, but it's an intelligence that's connected to the matter and energy. It's over it. It has authority over it. So there's definitely intelligence in everything that lives. I mean, the American Indians have, I forget what they call it. The Chinese call it chi. There's different cultures and religions that speak of
chakras. You know, chakras in the Eastern tradition. You know,
all the different places. There is a connection between consciousness and the forces of nature and matter and energy. No doubt about it.
Yeah, and once again, I think it really just comes down to vibration. It is that rotational speed and being able to match that, you know, kind of, hey, kind of for you nerds out there like me, kind of like the Flash, you know, the way that he can go up to a wall and touch it and vibrate his atoms at the same speed and pass through it. Same concept.
Yeah.
You just got to be able to get your vibration up to that point.
I've heard some, you know, I've read some books, a Whitley Strieber book that sounds like they do that.
Yeah.
Like the aliens come right through the walls and stuff.
Yeah.
That book was so disturbing, I had to stop reading
it. Oh, man.
Because if that was true, it would be like living in a nightmare.
Yeah. Whitley Strieber is a dream guest of mine. I grew up listening to, he had a show out of San Antonio that used to come on. And I'd catch that late at night on Sundays in Houston, and I loved that show. It was fantastic. But yeah.
If even half of what he's saying is true, man, that's a nightmare.
Well,
I mean, I would not want to be an abductee with all that stuff going on. Holy cow, what a terrible thing to have to deal with.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know... Mark, thank you so much for coming on the show tonight, for breaking this down. Like I said, I would love to have you on again and again to talk about these kind of things, because this stuff pops up in the news so frequently. There are so many new discoveries that are burgeoning, that are happening, that are out there. And I don't think that people are... It's not that I don't think that people are ready for it. It's that I'm not sure if people are ready for the speed at which this change could happen.
That's right. There'll be a new normal in the world if what I have in my book comes true. If we accept that anti-gravity exists and start manufacturing these machines, the supercar will become possible. And that's stuff we could talk about when I'm on next time. Finish the book.
God, yes.
And make your questions up, and we'll have another discussion or two.
Oh, absolutely. Like I said, I cannot wait to have you on again and again. This has just been super fantastic. As I've been reading over the last few days, my noodles just been cooking. So it's been great. Mark, thank you so much for coming on tonight. Tell everybody where they can go, of course, other than the Dudes and Beer store. Where can they go to get your book? Where can they go to catch up with your blog, everything else?
That's on www.super-relativity.com, super-relativity.com. And there's a link to the Amazon book. You could get the Kindle or the paperback from Amazon. And I offer right now a signed version you can get. I have limited books here, a limited amount, and I'll keep trying to do that for a while longer.
Nice.
But it creates a lot of extra work for me.
It does. That's why they're always in a limited number.
But it's nice to have the contact, because I get to send them a letter thanking them for buying the book, which I can't do on Amazon. I have no idea who's buying the books. They don't give me any kind of statistics or facts of that type. I guess it's to protect.
Well, you got one Kindle purchase from me.
Yeah. Well, I'll put you on my mailing list. I'm going to try to start giving people, you know, updates other than just Facebook is all I'm doing right now.
Well, but, the blog is fantastic as well. Make sure to go on by and check that out as well, folks.
Yes.
That is super-relativity.com/blog. That's where you can find all of these articles that Mark was referencing earlier about does the ether exist, about the magnetic fields that we were discussing. I could do a whole episode on gravitational lensing and all that kind of stuff. So yes, until next time, please do hold the line, Mark, while we close things out. While you're online checking out all the fantastic work of Mark Fiorentino, make sure to stop on by dudesandbeer.com, folks. That is where you can find all of the episodes. That's where you can find the news you can use section. You can stop on by and check out all the platforms. There's like 30 something platforms. If you use a platform, to listen to podcasts that you do not see us on, let us know and we'll get on there for you. Till next time, everybody, take care of yourselves, take care of each other. If you can't be good, be good at it. We'll talk to you soon. Episode 300 coming up soon. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Dudes and Beer Podcast. To listen to our audio streams or chat with us live, download the official Dudes and Beer app for Android and iDevices, available on Google Play and iTunes Market.
Being rebuilt
right
now.
For more episodes, content, and information, visit us online at dudesandbeer.com. You can also find our episodes on Breach.tv, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Dudes and Beer is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more about our sponsors and other podcasts on this network, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com. Thanks for listening, everybody, and until next time, drink responsibly.